It's the 20th of July, 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. How are creationists getting to run free schools when the government's free school policy shows absolutely no evidence of intelligent design? Now that ex-Muslim Alam Shahar has written a Young Atheist's Handbook, is it possible that his book will be taken out of context and used to justify violence in 1,000 years' time? And if everything else is futile, is sport even slightly more futile than that? But first, the regular begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then do head over to our website and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. Go on, it's like buying us a couple of drinks a month. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. But now, on with the show, and we start this week with the news that the government have approved several new free schools that look as if they're going to teach creationism. So some of these schools have said that they won't teach creationism in science, and that the schools would merely have a creationist ethos. So, in that spirit, whilst I'm not going to say that Michael Gove, the Education Secretary, is a pandering, weak-willed twat for allowing this to happen, I'm just going to approach what he says with that sort of ethos. To find out more, Liz Luckendorf has been speaking to the British Humanist Association's education campaigner, Richie Thompson.
It was announced this week that the government are approving three state-funded creationist free schools. Can you tell us any more about this?
Well, all three groups have put out statements which suggest that they hold creationist beliefs. All three have now said, it wasn't what they said at the time, but all three have now said that they will not teach creationism in science. However, all three do intend to teach creationism in religious education, which to our mind is just as serious.
What's the difference? Why is it as bad to teach in RE as it is science?
Well, if you teach one thing in one subject and another thing in another, then that seems to me is just as likely to confuse people as if you teach two different things in the same subject. So children who are taught in science that evolution is true and in religious education that creationism is true, many of them will end up believing in creationism. That was seen quite clearly a few years ago when Richard Dawkins visited a Muslim school in his Faith School's Menace documentary on Channel 4. We know that the government agrees. So last year, Nick Gibb said much the same, really. He said that religious belief should not be presented as scientific theory. As with any other subject of the curriculum, RE should be taught in an objective, impartial and accurate manner. On no account should it be used as an opportunity for those of a particular faith to attempt to embed their own particular views or beliefs into children.
So recently the BHA won a decision in the Information Commissioner about the setting up of various faith schools and free schools. Will this basically help us fight against these kind of schools being established?
I think it might. So what that ruling was about is that at the moment, as free schools are being set up, so the first step is that they apply to the Department for Education. Then the Department for Education decides that whether or not it wants to back them. And if it decides it will back them, that's known as pre-approval. And then from there, over the course of the next 10 months, they hold their local consultation, do various steps in setting up, and then at the end of that period, they sign their funding agreement in which they have final agreement with the government to be established. So for reference, the free schools due to open this September signed their funding agreement last month, and the free schools due to open next September in 2013 have just been pre-approved. And the situation at the moment is that schools that are pre-approved, often we don't know about them before they are announced as pre-approved, before they get government backing to open. And this seems to me and to many others to be a deeply biased system that faith groups perhaps could gather support within their local churches in order to show that they have the support for the school that leads to the government to be to approve them, and yet they're not subjected to scrutiny until after they're pre-approved and after the government is already working in support of them opening. And that seems to me to be a very concerning state of affairs. So anything that allows that scrutiny to come earlier seems like it would be a good thing that would lead to better schools.
And I guess the BHA is going to be campaigning against this. So how can we help the BHA, or what can we do independently to fight against these creationism being taught in schools, essentially?
Well, with these three schools specifically, we've got a facility on our website through which you can email both your MP and Michael Gove, who will identify who your MP is for you. It's got suggested text, so it's very easy to just take that and adapt it to say what you want to say and send that off. And we're very pleased that in the first couple of days we've had about 3,000 emails sent. So it'd be great if the Pod Delusion could plug that, and if Pod Delusion listeners were to do that. If you live in Sevenoaks or Nottinghamshire or Sunderland, where one of these three schools have been set up, it would be great if you could get involved at local level, work with other local campaigners to oppose the schools. Please contact me if you want to do that. And in general, I think it's important to continue to scrutinise free school bids. Look out for new proposals for faith schools in your area. Let us know if you see them. Check what they're saying, and we can just continue to push back against this.
We'll put all those links on the Pod Delusion website, Richie. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, if you're listening to the show on the day of release, the 20th of July, then today is the anniversary of something incredibly significant in human history, and coincidentally, the anniversary of the subsequent beginning of the plateauing of human achievement. As Drury explains in this next report.
Friday, 20th of July, 2012, is the 43rd anniversary of the moon landing by Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. For those of us born since that date, it's easy to forget that this was achieved using 1960s technology. For most of the 60s, they didn't have felt-tip pens, pocket calculators, or random access memory, but they put people on the moon. Oh, for our younger listeners, a pocket calculator was something like an iPhone, except that it only ran one app, which was a calculator app. It had a screen worse than the one on your Blu-ray remote control, and it wasn't actually a phone. Those things had to be permanently plugged in. And the pocket calculator had only just been invented when we put a man on the freaking moon. Even today, a rocket that fails 1 in 20 launches is considered reliable. By the time Apollo 11 launched, 10 US or Soviet astronauts had died in training, including Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space. Two astronauts, Michael Adams and Vladimir Komarov, had actually died during missions. Adams in a suborbital X-15 accident, and Komarov when parachutes failed to deploy from the Soyuz 1. Neil Armstrong himself was on board Gemini 8 when a thruster's failure caused an almost fatal spin. Whilst Apollo 11 flew without major incident, Apollo 12 was struck twice by lightning, Apollo 13 suffered an oxygen tank explosion, and one of the parachutes collapsed on Apollo 15. Since that time, the USA has experienced two fatal flights, with the losses of Challenger and Columbia. The Soviet Union lost three astronauts on Soyuz 11 and had two rockets explode on the ground, with a total of 60 casualties. Let's not forget that Armstrong, Aldrin, and their command module pilot, Michael Collins, took a very brave step for mankind. Spaceflight today is not significantly safer than it was when Apollo 11 launched, but it's much more routine. Last year there were 78 successful launches, with 7 of them carrying human crew. Since we first put a man on the moon, there have been 5 more successful USA manned missions to the moon. There have been 3 manned rover vehicles successfully landed on the moon. There have been 5 successful Soviet moon missions returning samples or operating rovers. There have been successful moon missions by China, Japan, India, and the European Space Agency. Since we first put a man on the moon, France, Japan, China, the UK, India, Israel, the Ukraine and Iran have all established space launch programs, as demonstrated by successful orbital launches. Dozens of other countries have sent satellites into orbit on top of rockets operated by those places. Russia, the USA, the international community, and China have all launched and operated space stations. Probes have landed on Venus, Mars, the asteroids Eros and Itokawa, the comet Temple, and the Jupiter moon Titan. Voyager 1 has reached the heliosphere, the edge of the solar system. So, standing on the shoulders of giants, where will we go next? Well, the most ambitious milestone we've got planned for the next 20 years? Sending another manned mission to the moon. Go figure. Don't for a moment believe that modern astronauts lack the physical courage of the Apollo team with the right stuff. The problem is that Challenger and Columbia weren't the result of cutting-edge risk-taking. They were victims of lethal bureaucracy. The good news, though, is that NASA isn't the only organization planning a moon trip. We have better, more realistic details leaking from the secretive Chinese space planning than from the US press releases. With any luck, there is a new space race starting. China is the clear favorite, followed by India and private industry as likely contenders. With any luck, one of the outsiders, like Japan, Iran, or the USA, will step up to make it a four-cornered contest. The race is starting back to 1969. This is Drew Ray for the Poddelusion.
Now, earlier in the week, we got the chance to speak to Alam Shahar about his new book, The Young Atheist's Handbook. It's a fascinating memoir about how he grew up in South London and eventually, spoiler alert, ends up as an atheist. This actually surprised me, as when he told me that he was an ex-Muslim, I was hoping that the book would be about when he met Charles Xavier and learned to control his powers. It turns out that Alam's only power is being able to write really good books. So here's me and Liz speaking to Alam. I started by asking him to describe the book.
I guess it's my personal journey from growing up in a Bangladeshi Muslim community to being one of, you know, relatively few open and out atheists from my kind of background.
The book was characterised in The Observer by Nick Cohen as being an escape memoir. Would you describe the book in those terms?
I think it's probably not an inaccurate description. I'm glad that Samira Ahmed said it wasn't a misery memoir, but it's definitely a memoir, and I guess to some extent it describes an escape from a kind of underprivileged background and that kind of nonsense, yeah.
The thing that surprised me about the book, even having, you know, spoken to you whilst you're working on it, is how just intensely personal the book is. Did you have any worries about revealing that much information about you and your family?
It was weird, I didn't really think about it while I was writing it. I mean, much of the book kind of seemed to flow out of me. And then the other day I was talking to someone who I didn't know very well, and they said something, and I said, "How do you know that?" And they said, "I've read it in your book." So, yeah, I think I've really opened myself up to the whole world, really. It's a bit weird, and maybe I should have thought about it in more detail before I did it.
Do you think that amount of context was necessary to sort of make the points you were trying to make?
It's funny, I never set out to write that particular book. It's called The Young Atheist Handbook because I originally set out to write much more of a handbook, a kind of guide to atheism for young people, because I felt that there was something missing in the kind of market out there. And when I took that idea to my agent, she said, "Well, you know, it's a very noble idea and all that, but nobody will buy it." She then encouraged me to write my personal story, which I started to do, and I really enjoyed doing it. And then we ended up with the book, which you've read. And I actually think it's a much better book than the one I was planning to write. It achieves something very different, which I think it reveals a very human side of atheism. And I think it lets people know that, you know, atheism can be for ordinary people. There's not this thing for kind of only intellectuals like Dawkins and Dennett and Grayling and that lot. And I also think that people respond better to stories. I think my initial plan for a book was just a kind of factual book. But actually, I think we win arguments better through storytelling than through kind of just presenting facts. And I think it's a better work of rhetoric, really.
In the book, throughout the course of the book, it starts when you're really young. You talk about perhaps your challenging childhood or some of the challenges you faced in that. And spoiler alert, you end up as an atheist.
Yeah.
Given some of the things that you went through, I'm not sure, you know, how much what you want to say about them now. Are there any concerns that this could lead to the argument that you're an atheist because of the things you experience rather than, say, derived through reason?
That's exactly what people have been saying. In fact, lots of I've had comments from people who've said, you only don't believe in God because you had such a rough time as a kid or whatever. I would just point to all the other atheists who had a much happier childhood. I think, unfortunately, I can't do the experiment. I can't go and relive my life in some other way and then investigate whether or not I would have been an atheist. So it's a rather pointless discussion to have. I think that actually, my childhood is the kind that usually turns people towards God, probably, in search of comfort and kind of meaning and so forth. So, yes, I absolutely think lots of people who don't want to kind of buy into what I'm saying will say, well, you know, he had a miserable childhood and that turned him against God. And if that's what they take away from it, then that's what they take away from it.
I guess one of the things which surprised me from the assumptions I made when I started reading as well was, for instance, you talk about your father and how he had some imperfections. What surprised me about when you spoke about him was his relatively relaxed approach to religion, because, going into the Young Atheist Handbook, given that you were raised, you know, Muslim, I was expecting it to have been quite a hardcore religious environment, which would have pushed you away. That's what I would have expected. But your dad took a rather relaxed approach.
I think it's interesting that you raise that, and I'm glad that you raised it, because I think, you know, my parents' generation weren't hardcore Muslims. I think the generation of Bangladeshi immigrants that my father was part of weren't Islamic in the same way that many young Bangladeshis are today. I think there's been a shift in identity values, if you like, and certainly a kind of post-11 phenomenon whereby people from Bangladeshi backgrounds and indeed Pakistani backgrounds and other ethnic minority backgrounds who may have considered, you know, being Muslim a small part of their cultural identity, now consider it a much more significant, if not the central part of their identity. And I think my parents' generation were actually a lot more relaxed about religion than this current generation of kind of British Asian youth.
Interestingly, you did have, I understand there was some challenges with the publishers.
Yeah,
getting the published.
Yeah, I think actually, firstly, there is no such thing as a Muslim community. I think British Muslims will just be kind of neither here nor there about the book. They'll just be like, yeah, whatever. Unfortunately, British publishers didn't respond like that. I feel that a number of British publishers certainly turned down the opportunity to publish my book because they felt that it was somehow going to endanger them, literally endanger them. And I think that's very sad. There's a kind of sad self-censorship going on there. And that's embedded in, I think, ultimately, prejudiced ideas about Muslims in the UK. And, sadly, that fear has been fed by one or two very unfortunate incidents in the past.
So in terms of sort of tone, this book is sort of the complete antithesis to the angry atheist, Dawkins-esque sort of books. I mean, is that something you deliberately went for? Is that just how you are? Or
I'd like to think that's just how I am. I think, to some extent, I can empathise with why some atheists are angry. I think they see a lot of the harm that religion does and so forth, and they feel they have to rail against that. But what I think a lot of these people forget is that, you know, there are lots of ordinary people who aren't doing horrid, evil things who consider themselves religious, you know, and we live with these people. And in my case, lots of these people are my friends. And I wanted to write a book that was empathetic of religious people, but at the same time explained clearly why some of us don't believe in God. And it's not an argument against religion as much as an argument for atheism. I think that's one of the key differences between my book and maybe one or two of the others out there.
I was going to ask, do you think you're still going to be able to escape that kind of angry atheist label? Because you imagine just the act of publishing is going to make people say, oh, well, you're, you know, proselytizing, as it were, like the Four Horsemen sort of thing.
I think it's kind of, it would be disingenuous of me to say that I wasn't proselytizing, because I genuinely believe that lots of people would lead happier lives if they just embraced atheism. I believe that lots of people don't really believe in the God that they have been brought up with. I think lots of people struggle with thinking and feeling that they have to believe in God when they don't really. And I think those people would be happier if they just accepted that this idea of God isn't one that suits them. I really do believe that. So yes, I am a proselytizer for atheism. However, at the same time, what's been really nice about having the book published in Australia first and now over here is I've had lots of positive feedback from religious people. You know, there's a lovely review online by a Christian who said, "This is not a book to argue with. This is a book to read and go away and think about."
Mm.
And I had in Australia lots of Catholics for some reason saying, "Look, I really liked your book." And I think what they might like about it is that I'm not shouting in their faces and saying, "You're wrong, you're evil." I'm just saying, you know, I don't believe in this stuff in a very kind of human way. And that, for me, what one of the things I want to get across with my book is that there is an ordinary atheism out there, an atheism of ordinary people who live their lives not believing in God. And getting along with those who do believe, you know, we're just another minority out there, and we need to get along with people of faith, because actually the majority of society seems to be made up of people of faith.
What I find interesting about your book is that you have a lot of the atheist books in general that come out, like from Dawkins and everyone, and the media seems to treat them, and people who interview treat them in a certain way of asking them about their atheism, or just assuming it's part of their character, I guess. How is, like, you've done a few interviews now, this is a bit of a meta question, but how are they treating you? Do you see them, like, them trying to skirt questions, or are they just straightforward asking you about your story?
The one question I'm really fed up of hearing is, you know, are you scared you're going to get attacked by Muslims or whatever? And I just think, you know, I'm kind of worried about the focus on that. I just feel that I've written a book which is entirely kind of inoffensive. And, you know, why would you ask me that question if you'd read the book? And the answer to that question is because you have a certain way of viewing the Muslim in the UK, or Muslims in general. You think that Muslims are undoubtedly going to respond violently to any form of criticism or whatever. And there is criticism of Islam in my book, absolutely, but there's also criticism of all the Abrahamic religions and religious ideas in general. So that's the one question I really don't like answering anymore.
And you probably have been asked this question a lot, but do you think you'll write another book?
Yes, do I think I'll write another book? I don't know. I hope I'll write another book. So for anyone out there listening who's interested in writing and all that stuff, that's a good question. I'd really like to talk about that, actually. And that's a question nobody's asked, so thank you, because that's something I want to share my delight in. I love books. You'll pick that up if you read my book. I absolutely love books. You know, I always wanted to write a book, but I never thought I would, because I've never imagined that I could, you know, create the kind of book that I love reading. And you know, whenever I read a book that I really like, I'm kind of in awe of the author's genius. I read a lot of fiction, and when I read a good book, I just think, my God, I absolutely believed in that world, and I absolutely love those characters. And I never imagined that I would be skilled enough to write a book like that. And indeed, I haven't written a book like that. I've cheated. I've written non-fiction, and the character in the book is me, and the world is a real one, so I've completely cheated. What I really enjoyed was the process of writing. I really enjoy writing. When I've got something I want to write, you know, there's a real thrilling getting the words out and on the paper or on the screen or whatever. And I would love to experience that thrill again. And I get it every time I write something. And I don't write much. I'm not a prolific writer. I don't blog much. I don't write many articles or whatever. And it's always a thrill for me, whether it's a kind of 600 word, you know, comment is free piece, or it's a chapter for a book or whatever. The thrill of writing is one of the kind of joys of my life, and I absolutely hope that I get to do that again. And I haven't written anything for ages. I'm feeling really awful. Like, I really want to write something.
So we'll leave it there. The book is available now. We'll put links to buy it on the Pod Delusion website. Alan, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
It turns out that the reason Alan wrote his book was because it was suggested to him by none other than A.C. Grayling. At the book launch last week, I managed to grab a brief word with Professor Grayling, and being the fearless, Paxman-like interviewer that I am, I didn't dare mention the new College of the Humanities once. Here's me and AC. Okay, so I'm here with AC Grayling, who helped Alum along the way writing the book. What exactly was your role in its creation?
Well, when I met Alum, I was very interested by him. Firstly, I noticed what a wonderful teacher he is, because he'd invited me to his school. That's not the reason why I thought he was a wonderful teacher. But I saw his interaction with his students and how very fond they were of him. And so I got chatting to him afterwards, and it was so interesting to meet somebody who come from a very, you know, a traditional Islamic background, but who was himself not a believer and who had been much influenced by his education and the fact that he's a scientist. And I said to him, your story is a really interesting one, you ought to write about it. And he was very sceptical about that. It seemed a strange suggestion, but I introduced him to my agent, Catherine Clark, who's a terrific agent, really looks after authors well, helps them with their work as she helped him, and the result has been this book, which is terrific.
Do you reckon that we could help reach a new audience?
I hope so, yes. I mean, when people hear about it, it might be, you know, Alan himself is a little diffident about the title, but when people hear about the book and they hear it's a personal story of somebody who comes from that community and has reached the sort of outlook that Alan now has, they may be really intrigued by that. And it's a very nice, you know, combination on the one hand of discussion of the views, of the beliefs, but also his own personal story. And it's a very poignant one, a very courageous one also, though he's terribly modest about that. I think the book will be great help to people who want to try to take that journey themselves, because they'll see it kind of gives them permission to do it.
Excellent, and we'll let you carry on with your evening. Anthony Grayling, thank you very much.
Lovely to see you.
You can hear an extended version of the interview with Alum on the Pod Delusion website. So when putting the show together every week, sometimes I'll send out suggestions to the mailing list, and last week I posed a simple question. What's the point in sport? You know, because the Olympics is starting to look a lot of faff, and there was all that racism in the Ukraine which didn't seem terribly pleasant. Well, Trent Burton took the bait, and in this next report argues that being a sports fan is a bit like being a member of a church. Now, I've never been to church, so I'm assuming this means flipping a coin at the start to decide if Jesus or Satan kicks off, having half-time oranges, and assuming my PE lessons were representative, getting beaten up in the changing rooms afterwards. Here's Trent to counter my naysaying. Before listening, I want you to warm up for it by pointlessly running to the other side of the field and back. Do I sound bitter?
I think I'm one of those extremely rare sort of geeks. The sort that likes three S's instead of the usual two. Skepticism, science, and sport. In fact, just a fortnight ago, I was flitting between gigs at the Cheltenham Science Festival and the MotoGP event at Silverstone for most of the week. Sport gets a bad rap amongst the geek community a lot of the time, and I've never been really sure why. I'm sure there's a lot of the Pod Delusion's target audience who aren't that into sport, but amongst skeptics, it's often more than that. Some sort of fervent hatred of it. A conviction that, say, football, for example, and all associated with it, would sooner smash a bottle in your face than give you the time of day. And I just don't buy into that. Now, I'm not saying there's no nerds or skeptics that like sport at all. Obviously, there is. There's many amongst my own friends, and there's some pretty famous ones, too. Richard Herring's devotion to York City Football Club is legendary, and Stephen Fry seems to bleed willow over the summer, but on the whole, I think it's fair to say we're in a minority. When people who don't like sport, and we're talking about professional sports here, are asked to say what they think about it that's wrong, you get the usual story of hooliganism, it's a waste of money, there's lots of faff, it breeds racism, and so on. When asked for the positive, you get, oh, I don't know, I suppose if some kids kick a ball around, they mightn't get so fat or something. So here, as I see it, are some of the positives that rarely get mentioned. Watching pro sports is just like watching a movie. It's entertainment. Okay, it might not be a Kubrick, but it's just as intellectual as something like the Avengers. And then there's the community aspects. One of the few positives I can see of church is the community aspect. With sport, a group of people with a common belief get together to celebrate it. Instead of praying to some made-up god or marginalising gays, however, sports fans generally just want a goal or a wicket. Back when I lived in Australia, I was a member of the Fremantle Australian Rules Football Club. Every other week, I'd go to the ground with a friend, we'd sit in the same seat and be surrounded by the same people who we never saw anywhere other than at the stadium. They got to be footy friends in the same way that I imagine people have church friends. And no one ever stabbed anyone or said who could marry who. And we still have that same joy of having blind faith. In fact, when I interviewed Marcus Tasutoi last year, he said the only thing he believed in without evidence was that Arsenal would win the Premiership each year. And from what I understand, the evidence really does suggest otherwise. And then there's also a big science aspect to it, if that's your sort of thing. I've been a motorcycle racing fan since I can remember. The increased level of technology and engineering in that sport in particular is incredible. In fact, my first understanding of physics actually came from watching bike racing. When I was around 9, I asked my science teacher why the bikes didn't just fall over when they leant so far when they ran around the corners, and so I learned about the basics of centrifugal force. Or take cricket, another sport that I enjoy watching. If you want to understand how swing bowling works, you've got no hope unless you understand some fundamental flow physics and air resistance, whether you realise that that's what you're actually understanding or not. And you could say it's a microcosm for life if you wanted to be really wanky, and that kind of interests me. The hard work, the competition, the rivalry, it's all very grand and Shakespearean. That kick after the siren to win the game, or the last corner pass, or a six off the final ball, it's pure theatre. But people will still say that overall, sports is a force for bad. It's well and good that some people enjoy it, but look at football. It's a breeding ground for thugs and racism. It's a big two. Still with the racism first. Yes, there is racism in football. There's also racism in my street, and it's equally disgusting. But one is on the telly and one isn't. The difference is that when someone in football says something racist or homophobic, they're punished for it. Kids watching that are taught that this sort of thing is bad and can't be tolerated. I mean, any kid that's ever watched American basketball is subjected to the subconscious realisation, I guess, that only when black and white people work together can they succeed. That might sound ridiculous, but it's also true. How many kids in the 80s saw the friendship between the great rivals Larry Bird and Magic Johnson and learned a little something? One of my fondest memories in sport was in 2003 when I travelled to Melbourne with a big group of sporting nuts for the Davis Cup tennis final between Australia and Spain. During the matches, there was cheering and singing and drinking from the Australian group supporters and also the Spanish. We cheered loudly for our team, they for theirs. We took the piss out of them, they took the piss out of us, and nothing would have pleased each other more than to see the other team lose. Australia did end up winning, and directly after the match, the big group of Australian fanatics and Spanish fanatics ended up in the same pub, buying each other beers, and then learning the songs of each other's countries that we'd been singing all day. So if sport breeds racism, someone obviously forgot to tell about 800 of us. And so to the violence. And this is what annoys me more than anything about the criticism levelled at football, and that's one of the few sports that I don't even like a little bit. This is where sceptics in particular let themselves down. Where they become the sort of question time guests they spend their mornings abusing on Twitter, resorting to the sort of generalisations that they often abhor. Now, not to generalise myself, I realise that this isn't true of us all, but there's certainly a large percentage of sceptics that resort to such a view. They've decided that sport is bad, and so it is. The fact is, there's very little evidence to suggest so. The statistics released by the Home Office for the 2010-11 football season in England showed over 37 million people attended matches. Less than 0.01% of that figure were involved in police intervention. 51% of matches didn't even require any police attendance. And that's on par with any other large event, like a concert or a football. You could argue that it's even better, given the regularity that football matches are played throughout the country. But obviously that isn't covered as much by the news as a riot, because it's much less sensational. Now, when that sort of coverage is used in relation to protests, we're all up in arms. But when it's a football match, they're all hooligans. The evidence, the statistics, and the facts show that this perceived notion of sport, particularly football, being populated by hooligans, is just not the case. They are a tiny minority, yes, in much the same way that they are in any large public gathering. And let's be honest here. What's more painful in the long run? A bit of a shove by some guy that's had a pint too many? Or that raised hand at a skeptics event that's followed by, This isn't really a question so much as a statement. I'm writing a book at the moment myself. This has been Trent Burton for The Pod Delusion.
So it's been a couple of weeks now since we've had it confirmed to within 5 sigma, whatever the fuck that means, that the Higgs boson probably definitely exists, maybe. Which is good news, probably, maybe. Tom Williamson, though, has been trying to get his head around it all, as it's quite hard to explain. I mean, if you're anything like me, then you get that it's important, but you don't really understand what the hell is going on. So it's basically just like Prometheus. So Tom has been trying to find the perfect analogy for it. Personally, I won't be happy until someone explains the Higgs in media-friendly units. I want to know the size of the Higgs in terms of double-decker buses. Here's Tom, who's 0.6 times the height of a female elephant, explaining more.
The world of science is currently abuzz with the news that physicists at CERN have discovered the Higgs boson. However, for a layperson like myself, this is something that can be pretty tough to understand. I have a keen interest in science and have made an effort to comprehend the significance of the Higgs boson that makes extensive use of analogies. I'd love to know if I'm anywhere near understanding quantum physics or if I'm way off the mark, so I'd invite anyone to criticise the following piece. First off, what is the Higgs boson? As far as I know, it's a particle that gives all other particles mass, mass being equivalent to weight on our planet. Like many things in quantum physics, I find this very counterintuitive. How can a particle, or indeed an atom, not have its own mass? How can it not weigh anything on its own? Surely mass is a property of a particle, just as, say, speed is a property of a moving car. To try and explain this idea, imagine tapping your fingers on a desk. It results in a noise. Now, are your fingers making the noise? Is the desk making the noise? Or is it the interaction between your fingers and the desk that causes the noise? Hopefully you can see it's the latter. Now, imagine atoms instead of your fingers, a load of Higgs bosons in place of the desk, and mass in place of noise. Just as noise is the result of your fingers interacting with the desk, mass is the result of particles interacting with the Higgs boson. It's a very tricky thing to do, but I believe that you have to think of mass not as a property that something has, but as something that comes from an interaction. Right, after I tried to accept that idea, I then had to picture where the Higgs boson fits in with my understanding of what matter is. I'm a biochemist by training, so I know that everything that's tangible, or if you like, stuff, is made of chemicals, which are composed of atoms. Each atom is composed of a nucleus of positive protons and neutral neutrons orbited by negative electrons, and each element is defined by how many protons are in the atom's nucleus. So, if your atom has 6 protons, you've got carbon, 7 is nitrogen, 8 is oxygen, and so on. These atoms join together to give pretty much everything in nature, including us. But once again, none of this would have mass if it didn't interact with the Higgs boson. Something else I need to examine, and something that always puzzled me about the Higgs, that it was often called a big fudge factor. And I think I understand why. Look at the periodic table of the elements, something that hangs on the wall of pretty much every science classroom. There is order to it. There is something strangely comforting about the fact that the building blocks of matter can be arranged into consistent rows and columns. Then look at the charges of protons and electrons. Again, you have a structure where one cancels out the other. If you dig down a little further, you'll see that protons and neutrons are composed of quarks, namely up and down quarks. An up quark has a positive charge of 2/3 and a down a negative charge of 1/3. A proton consists of 2 up quarks and a down, so the net charge is +1, whereas a neutron consists of 2 downs and an up, so the charge on a neutron sums to 0. You can see order and structure throughout physics and chemistry, that is, until you come to the Higgs boson. As far as I can tell, it just interacts with other particles to produce mass. That's it. It is fundamental for our current understanding of physics to be correct. It's absolutely everywhere, even in vacuums, but until recently it has been nigh on impossible to detect. I can hear theoretical physicists in the 70s sarcastically shouting, "Oh, how convenient!" No wonder it earned a reputation as a fudge factor. Yet, the fact that physicists are as certain as they can be that the Higgs has been discovered, and that it does explain so much, makes it a big deal. This I think I can understand, because it is a classic example of why people do science in the first place. We want to understand the universe that we live in. We develop theories to explain what we can observe. We use these theories to make predictions, and if these predictions turn out to be correct, then the theory that they originate from is strengthened, and we move towards a better understanding of our environment. In the case of the Higgs boson, it was predicted by Peter Higgs in 1964, but we haven't been able to properly test that prediction until recently. Now that we have, we can take our understanding of science even further, and I for one find that to be very exciting. I find the advancement of science to be paramount, even if it does cost billions and involves digging a 26-mile ring beneath two countries. So there you have it. There is my layman's take on what the Higgs boson is and why it's important. Please, if I've made any glaring errors, don't hesitate to correct me. This has been Tom Williamson for The Pod Delusion.
Staying with science, and if you're listening on the day of release, then get on down to Wrexham tonight, where our next contributor, Andrew Holding, will be giving a talk tonight on a chemical reaction that changed the world. Now you're intrigued. So Andrew's recorded a little bit of a preview for us. Here he is, talking about the Haber process.
At Sir William Crookes's inauguration speech at the British Association, he opened with the words, "England and all civilised nations stand in deadly peril." He proclaimed that mass starvation would hit the world by 1930. The cause? Advances in medicine from scientists like Lister, Pasteur and Jenner had caused a boom in the world's population, and that would lead to more mouths to feed. The result of his outcry was huge debate. Much like the discussion of climate change today, many at the time refused to believe Crookes's claims and denied the need to take action, believing him to be alarmist. Life needs a steady supply of nitrogen to create everything from amino acids to DNA. Nature obtains its supply from the rich abundance of gas in the air, but every molecule is made up from two tightly bonded single atoms. And despite this abundance, there are significant problems. Only a handful of bacteria are able to separate these atoms and convert them into fixed nitrogen, the form that is needed by plants to make the building blocks of life. To compound this problem, this is an immensely slow process. The solution is, of course, fertilizer, which allows farmers to speedily bypass this problem by directly adding fixed nitrogen into the soil, thus increasing crop yields, and importantly, producing more food to feed the world. Crookes was, of course, aware of the benefits of using fertilizer. In fact, just decades prior to his speech, the rise and fall of the Peruvian guano trade had been dramatic. The trade was based on the resources that had built up over thousands of years in the unique climate of islands off the Peruvian coast. Guano was so precious that after all the supplies had been squandered, battles had been fought, with both Spanish and the United States making ill-advised and unsuccessful claims to the last remnants of the supplies, and even led to the United States enacting the Guano Island Act, which was wholly unsuccessful. While the alternative source of horse manure was plentiful in the streets of Britain at the time, it had long since not been enough to fuel farmers' demands. Fortunately, a new source of fertilizer was found not far from Peru, in the Atacama Desert. The desert was covered with piles of a white substance called caliche that had long been ignored. This substance contained nitrates, another form of fixed nitrogen. Crookes warned, however, that this supply would not last forever, and therefore it would be down to the chemist to solve the problem of converting the unlimited resource of nitrogen in the air into a new source of fertilizer. The man who rose to the challenge to find this new source of fertilizer was a German called Fritz Haber. He discovered that by combining nitrogen from the air with hydrogen at immense pressure and in the presence of the metal osmium, he could produce ammonia. With ammonia being a form of fixed nitrogen, this was perfect for fertilizing crops. A second German called Karl Bosch took the incredible challenge to scale up the reaction to the levels needed to feed a nation. One issue he faced was that to make the project work, he would need more than all the osmium in the world as catalyst. But he convinced his employer, BASF, to buy all of it anyway and start researching a new, more widely available alternative. Reinventing the field, it was also dangerous work. The lab in which the new catalysts were developed had to run reactions for days to see if it would work, and at the pressures required, these vessels often failed during reaction. The result was explosions. But Bosch learnt from his mistakes, modifying and improving design of reactions, and even bomb-proof the lab to avoid delays. Despite the many setbacks that Bosch faced, after 5 long years he succeeded at producing fertilizer by the ton, for nothing more than air and hydrogen gas. This was testament to both his skills as an engineer and as a chemist. The process, though, had been incredibly difficult and expensive to develop, so much so that even Britain would not be able to develop a competing process for at least a decade, despite free access to Haber's chemistry publications, and even when they did succeed, it was by corporate espionage and the theft of detailed plans. However, a competing process threatened to bankrupt BASF and Bosch's work. Developed in Norway, it relied on cheap hydroelectric power to generate lightning in a box. As electricity flows through the air, the electrons are ripped from the oxygen and nitrogen, separating them into single atoms. These atoms can then recombine from other compounds, which include nitric oxide. As the mixture is cooled, the nitric oxide then combines with oxygen into nitrates. While this alternative was both far less efficient and far more expensive, as it requires huge amounts of electricity, the process was getting the backing of customers and governments. Nitrates had one major advantage over the Haber process, and that was they were not just a brilliant fertilizer, but they also could convert everyday substances into explosives. To save BASF, Bosch reluctantly implemented the process converting his own ammonia into nitrates. The chemistry was simple, but the personal cost was massive. Overnight, Bosch had gone from feeding a nation to fueling a war. The efficiency and success of his factories meant that when World War I broke out, with unlimited nitrates, it would last 4 long years, whereas without them, historians predict that perhaps the war may have only lasted 4 weeks. The impact of Carl Bosch's work played on him much in later life. In 1932, he said, "I have often asked myself whether it would have been better if we had not succeeded. The war perhaps would have ended sooner, with less misery and on better terms. Gentlemen, these questions are useless. Progress in science and technology cannot be stopped. They are in many ways akin to art. One can persuade the one to halt as little as the other. They drive people who are born for them to activity." This has been Andrew Holding, recording for The Pod Delusion. Thank you for listening.
You can find links to find out more about Andrew's talk in Wrexham tonight on the Pod Delusion website. Now, if you had last week's show, then you'll have heard our previews of a couple of shows that will be at the Edinburgh Fringe this August. And this week, we've got one more. Helen Keane, who you may know from the Radio 4 series, It's Rocket Science, is taking her new show, Robot Woman of the Future, up there. And we spoke to her to find out more. I started by asking her what the show was all about.
It's still a little bit nebulous, James, but yes, it's kind of about the future and my own enthusiasm from childhood for science fiction and the future, and my own very high, some might say, unrealistic expectations of the future, and also sex robots. That's what it's about, in a nutshell, listeners. Mm.
Yes. So you touch upon a number of fascinating futuristic things. I particularly like the Victorian images of the future. I mean, how do you find this stuff? Is this stuff you stumble on, or do you have to do specific research? Or?
Yeah, it's a bit of both, really. I mean, sometimes I just spend a lot of time procrastinating on the internet, and you find these things. And also people now kind of know that I do this sort of thing, and so I get kind of quite cool people sending me stuff, which is really nice when that happens. Because it's less work. But I do quite a lot of research as well. I go to the British Library and I kind of go through things and kind of think about it. And yes, kind of.
So you talked about one of your favourite authors was H.G. Wells.
Yes.
Are you a fan of the more classic sci-fi, or do you get into all the very new stuff about nanotechnology and all that weird stuff?
I think I like all of that shit. I had this really big phase as a kid, and then I sort of got steered away from it by my English teachers, who said, no, you should be reading something altogether more proper than this. And so I've kind of only got back into it recently. But yeah, I'm quite a broad church when it comes to science fiction. I kind of like I love the really trashy stuff. That was kind of one of the things that got me into it, the really trashy stuff when I was 12. So.
Well, one thing I thought was fascinating, perhaps your previous work and your previous show is about space and so on,
yeah.
And yet this show's about the future, but there wasn't many mentions of space. I mean, is that depressing? And does that mean there's no future in space?
I think that, oh, I think there's a huge, I think that's probably another show altogether, the future in space. And I think kind of I might actually put a few more bits in. I was sort of doing it a slightly different version of the show tonight, but yeah, there might actually be a bit about space when it's finally when it finally all comes together in a horrifyingly short period of time when I have to do it in Edinburgh.
So how complete is the show now? Because we're recording this maybe 10 days prior to August.
My heart. Sorry. If you'd had me wired up to an ECG, then that would have been terrifying. It's getting there. I'm a bit of a last minute person. I've realised that this is just what I'm like, and I always just do things at the last minute, and that's just what I'm like. So yeah, but it will be ready for the Edinburgh Fringe. It will be in a state of high readiness. That is my prediction for that this particular future. Yes.
So the big question around the end of the show, and not to give too much away, I guess, why are there no male sex robots?
I think there are. I think people are working on the male sex robots, but presumably it is some sort of market-led decision to go with the ladies, first of all. I don't know. I will be honest, I haven't looked into it that closely. I do not know any sex robots. I certainly don't own any. But yes, it is kind of...
When researching this, did you have to like look over your shoulder or anything? Or?
Yeah, I sometimes when I'm like going through stuff if I'm sitting on the train and I've got my laptop open, and I do kind of see people's heads sort of slightly drifting to the side when they see what's on my screen, and I kind of want to go, no, it's entirely kosher, it's research, it's fine. I'm not looking at weird porn in a public place on a train. That's not what I'm doing.
So where can people see the show, and when's it on in Edinburgh?
It's on at the Pleasance Courtyard at 3:30 in the Pleasance Hut. Hut being a euphemism for porter cabin. I'm not talking. It'll be great. I haven't talked it up. I've got to get the last desperate moment of Edinburgh spiel, Edinburgh kind of plugging going on there. But yes, that's
excellent. And we'll put links to buy tickets and find out more about it on the Podillusion website.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finally this week, a quick reminder that we're now only a couple of weeks away from Questival, the weekend event in a field organised by the AHS, the Federation of Student Atheist, Humanist and Secularist Societies, who, if they don't get a shorter acronym, I'm going to stop talking about. To find out what's going to be happening, though, I caught up with the outgoing secretary, Mike Painter, who started to explain what Questival is all about.
Well, Questival is a weekend where young freethinkers come together in a field. It's the biggest camp for atheist youth in the UK, and caters for young people, 18 and over, as well as the young at heart. So if you're older but you don't mind mucking around in tents and stuff, then come along as well. It was started 3 years ago as an alternative to religious summer camps and is a mentally and physically active weekend for young adults with a naturalistic worldview.
And who can we expect to see at Questival?
Well, we've got quite a few people. So from the apostasy side of thing, we've got Alom Shahar, who's an ex-Muslim who's recently released his book, The Young Atheist's Handbook. We've also got Johnny Scaramanga, who is a Podillusion favourite, who will be talking to us as well. And if all of that ex-religion stuff isn't enough for you, we will also be having a Flying Spaghetti Monster service, because we've got loads of activities as well as speakers that will be happening over the weekend.
Excellent. And it's a big it's an active weekend. It's not just talks, is it? There's people doing physical activities.
Yeah, so it's a big mix of things, really. There's lots of stuff for everyone. We've got the big event of the weekend is a photo challenge where you go around Stratford and have to take photos of different places and be the one the team to do it in the quickest time. We've got the Atheist Olympics. Who is the best atheist? Who is the best young atheist in the country? We will be finding out. And, of course, we also have the Podillusion. You have you guys coming along to do live and in the field reporting on our fascinating and interesting members, and they can come and do a mini Podillusion recording for you there.
Excellent. Is it literally going to be in the field?
Literally in a field. It's at Stratford Racecourse. That's a type of field. There will be grass. There will be field things like maybe rain, but probably not. Probably not rain, because it's going to be a fantastic weekend without any rain at all.
That sounds optimistic. Okay,
yeah.
So, and the big event, which I don't think you've mentioned yet, is I see on the website a mysterious and magical ghost cruise. But aren't we all sceptical rationalists here?
Well, you see, I was trying to cover that one up clearly, wasn't I? Yep, we will be going on a magical boat cruise. But don't worry, there'll be plenty of skeptics around to debunk any ghosts should they appear.
Excellent. And give us the details. When, where, what, why, how?
It will be held between the 3rd and 5th of August near Stratford-upon-Avon, so that's in 2 weeks' time. The ticket deadline is just 1 week away, and tickets have been selling very strongly, so people should go online to questival.org.uk and buy their tickets now, because it will be a fantastic weekend.
Excellent, and we'll put links to find out more about all of that sort of thing, and links to buy tickets and so on the Pod Delusion website. Mike Painter, thank you very much. And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and listen to nearly 3 years of archives. And do remember, if you have enjoyed the show, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. They help us pay the server fees and keep doing the show week in, week out. Go on, it's like buying us a couple of drinks a month. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Drew Ray, Trent Burton, Tom Williamson, and me, James O'Malley, with much additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The sketch of the moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
The security sorted, the opening ceremony sorted, I've been allocated the tickets I wanted. I think we've got the Olympics all covered.
Indeed, Minister.
Except, Bradshaw, I can't say I've seen an awful lot of athletes arriving.
Well, Minister.
Yes, Bradshaw?
We don't have any. Well, not enough at any rate. We got a call on Wednesday from the rest of the world to say that due to the economic climate and the extra baggage allowance for javelins on Ryanair, they're only sending 2,000 athletes of the 10,000 we were expecting.
Good Lord! This is an absolute shambles. What on earth are we doing about it?
Well, we think the army will make up a lot of the shortfall.
Then what does that mean?
Well, we won't be short of starter pistols.
Look, Bradshaw, I was looking forward to watching the women's volleyball. I don't want to watch a bunch of half-naked squaddies leaping around in the sand.
Don't worry, Minister. We do have another string to our bow, as it were. We've decided to go out and pull people in off the street to perform in the events as well.
Members of the public? But they'll be useless. They'll have no discernible skills or stamina. Won't people notice?
We've done it before, Minister.
Have we?
Oh, yes. How do you think we ended up with a coalition government? And the England European Cup squad.
Well, if we're all going to have to muck in together, bags me on the women's volleyball team. You never know, I might meet a few babes out on the sand. If you can't beat 'em, join 'em. That's what I always say, Bradshaw.
Yes, I know, Minister. That's why I've laid out your Lycra outfit in the changing room.
Good man. Let the games begin.